It's already 5 past, so might as well begin now. As some of you who've been on retreats before notice that on these morning talks I try to focus on just on the practice of meditation and giving as little theory as possible, simply because you can read the theory in books or listen to how it all is supposed to be in cassette talks or MP3s. But here I wanted to really stress just how we meditate and how we develop our mind, to give like the practical tips of how to get there rather than a description of what you'll experience once you're there. And as some of you have experienced, when you get into reasonably deep meditations, those deep meditations are just so difficult to describe because they are states of consciousness which we very rarely visit. And because human beings have had little experience of those states, sometimes we don't even have the language to describe them. And for those of you who've tried to describe your experiences to me in the interviews, just know how difficult it is to put these things into words. Which is why that I found it far more useful to try and dig out from the experience of ordinary life some similes or metaphors, which are not exactly the same as the experience being described, but are close enough to bring out some of the important features. And it's those similes and metaphors which give the best descriptions of both how to attain those states and what actually those states are and how to deal with them. And one of the metaphors which I've developed over the years, which I haven't mentioned yet, is going to be the subject or the focus of today's talk. And that is the simile of the thousand-petal lotus. It is a simile which is from the Tibetan tradition, but nevertheless it's an accurate simile which you can make use of for describing both the process of meditation, including the functions of samatha or calm, and the functions of deep seeing or insight, and sometimes the strange insights, the shocking insights like I described yesterday. But it also shows you just how this whole process unfolds. And it's a very useful simile because it gives you a more of a feeling of how to do it and what happens. The simile of the thousand petal lotus, and I'll be adding some extra things to it in the course of this talk. The simile of the thousand petal lotus is derived from the fact that the lotus flower closes up all its petals at night time. And in the first rays of the sun, the lotus opens out. And after a few hours, you know, an ordinary lotus in a pond or in a lake is actually fully opened to the sun, receiving all the sun's rays. And the simile works on the fact that the sun has to maintain its warmth on the lotus petals for them to open, and also that they open sequentially. So the outer layer of petals opens first. And when the outer layer of petals has opened up, only then can the sun reach the next layer of petals to warm that layer up, because that also needs to receive the warmth and the light of the sun for it to do its opening job. And that opens out, and then that reveals the next layer of petals, so that can feel and experience the warmth and open up in turn. Every layer of petals has to open up one after the other, because it does need the warmth of the sun to open it up. And that way, the lotus opens up gradually, layer by layer, until it's fully open. Now, what we mean here is the nature of the mind opens up layer by layer by layer, which is why I talk about the stages of meditation. You have like the stage of, you know, just sitting down and just being physically still. Then you've got the stage of present moment awareness. And then you've got the stage of silence. Then you've got the stage of being aware of the breath. Then you've got the stage of being aware of the whole breath from beginning to end. Then you've got the stage of the beautiful breath. And once the beautiful breath disappears, you've got the stage of the nimittas. And after the nimittas, you've got the stage of the first jhana. Then the second jhana. I haven't said much about the jhanas yet. But these are other layers of petals, third, fourth jhana, the first arupa, second arupa, third arupa. They're not really jhanas, but they're called jhanas in the commentaries. These are immaterial states of consciousness. And then the fourth immaterial state, and followed by the complete opening up of the lotus. Now that's actually the path of meditation. And you can imagine that each one of those stages I've mentioned are just like different layers of the petals. And the beauty of this simile, there's many advantages in this simile, is first of all that when the lotus is closed up, the outermost petals of the lotus, the ones which receive the wind and the dust and the battering from the rain and the storms, they are coarse, not particularly beautiful, certainly not fragrant. They are rough because they are weathered. Now that's the outermost petal of any lotus. You can see it when it's closed up. The outermost shell of petals is not very beautiful. It's rough and wrinkled. But you know from experience that inside that rough, unpromising petals, there are the beautiful petals. And as you go deeper into that lotus, you know that in the center you've got some very delicate, refined, beautiful, fragrant petals. That's where the scent is, in the middle. Now understanding that inside this hopeless, wrinkled, weathered, dirty, old mind of yours, in the center of that is this beautiful stages of nimittas and jhanas and enlightenment, and right in the center gives you a very good description of what this path of meditation is. It is accurate to say you all have jhana in this moment, but it's covered up by all these other layers. And even there's enlightenment right in the center there. But it's covered up with layer after layer after layer of activities. And your job is to somehow peel away those activities to reveal what's in the center. Or, as we use in the simile of the lotus, your job is to peel off those layers of petals to find out what's inside. But already, that metaphor of peeling off doesn't really work, because that's not how a lotus opens. A lotus opens, you need the sunshine to warm it, gently, persistently, for a long period of time. So your unpromising state of mind, no matter what you think you've done so far in this retreat, you've all got jhanas, only they're right inside there. Now how you open up the mind, I said, is not through peeling it, through an act of will. You don't do it. The sun in this simile represents mindfulness. But a mindfulness which doesn't move. Sometimes what I usually term unconditional mindfulness. Usually we use the word unconditional before loving-kindness in Buddhism. We say unconditional loving-kindness. The door of my heart is open to all beings, no matter who they are. My enemies, the ugly ones, you know, the terrorists, the prime ministers and presidents, all people, as well as the nice people as well. That's what we call unconditional love. But now I've taken that word unconditional and put it in front of mindfulness. Because that gives this idea of mindfulness just another level of power. To be aware unconditionally. It doesn't matter what you're watching, you're going to watch it. You're going to watch without judging. You're just going to see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or even just know. Unconditionally, just to receive without rejecting or holding on. In the same way that you can love anything with unconditional love, so you can be aware and mindful of anything with unconditional mindfulness. And that unconditional mindfulness represents the sun. As the Buddha once said, just as the sun shines unconditionally on all beings in this world, the murderers and the saints, it shines on everybody unconditionally. In the same way, our mindfulness just shines on this moment, whatever we're experiencing, unconditionally. That's the only way the sun is still enough. That's the only way mindfulness can remain long enough to do its job of opening. So that simile brings into a very sharp focus the idea of stillness. If you can imagine that sun shining on a lotus, and suddenly, say, a cloud comes along and blocks off the sun, what happens to the lotus? Bang, 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 it all closes up again. Or say if there's an eclipse or something, then because the sun's rays are interrupted, the lotus petal closes. And it closes much faster than it opens. It takes less time to close than it does to open it up. So understanding that, you understand your mindfulness, your attention, has to be on whatever you're experiencing now, and not moving. Not going somewhere else. One of the mistakes which people make when they meditate is always going on to the lotus next door, never staying on this one. That's what we call going on to the next stage, or on to the next thing, or on to the next moment. Never really remaining here long enough for things to happen. When you understand that simile, you can understand your mindfulness, you know, your awareness, your attention. Keep it still on what you're experiencing unconditionally. And then things begin to open up. The next stage is not somewhere else. The next stage of meditation is right inside the stage you're on now. It opens out. That's why that on something like sloth and torpor, the dullness of the mind, I've said consistently here, accept it, don't fight it, make peace with it, stay with it. Don't reject it. If you stay with sloth and torpor is like one of these lotuses with these very dark and weathered outside petals. But you know inside there, there's beauty, there's bliss, there's peace, there's energy. So all you need to do is sloth and torpor. Think of that as a petal of a lotus. And your job is not to move, just warm it up. Warm it up with unconditional mindfulness. And as you're warming it with unconditional mindfulness, the moment comes, and it's a great moment to observe, the sloth and torpor just fades. It just parts, just like the mist clearing in the morning. And you can see the mindfulness is clear and sharp, and you're reasonably peaceful. You've gone inside the center of the sloth and torpor. It even works with restlessness as well. For those people who are restless and they can't meditate, they can't sit, they can't walk, you know, they can't sort of have a cup of tea and coffee, they can't rest, they can't do anything. Ah! Just leave it alone. Just make peace with it. Be still. And eventually the thing wears out. There's a classic story from the early years of this monastery at Wat Nanachat, and we use these stories from real life again as metaphors, and many people hearing this story can relate to it and understand, yes, this is how I solved the problem of my restless mind. It was a story that when Ajahn Jagwa was the abbot of Wat Nanachat, so this was about 30 years ago, maybe 29 years ago, one of the villagers early in the morning was taking his water buffalo out to the fields to graze. As it passed by our monastery, just on the road bordering our monastery, the water buffalo took fright and began to run away. Now water buffaloes are very, very strong. And even so, though some of these Thai farmers, they look wiry, but they've got a lot of strength to them because of their hard lifestyle. But this one wasn't so bright. There was a string around the water buffalo's neck, and he was holding the string. It wasn't very thick, maybe about the size of this cord for the microphone. And he tried to hold the water buffalo back from running off. Now, water buffalo is so much stronger than a human being. The string or the cord wound around this farmer's finger and pulled the top of his finger off as the water buffalo ran away. So this poor man, because he was next to the monastery, he came for help, you know, holding his finger with the bone sticking out and blood coming down. It was a grisly sight to see. So Ajahn Jagra, just before we were going on alms round, so he never went to alms round this morning, he called a car from the village and took the poor guy to hospital just to get him patched up. You know, it was okay, because as long as you don't get an infection, he just had a shorter finger, you know, for the rest of his life. But there's no real damage. But we often remembered that story and used it as a simile for the restless mind. I don't care how long you've been meditating or how clever you think you are at working with your mind, there will come times in everybody's meditation practice, including the nuns and the monks, when your mind is like a water buffalo and it just wants to run off. What some people do, they try and stop their mind, thinking that you can control your mind, that you are stronger. Now that's conceit. If the water buffalo mind arises in you, and your mind is like this water buffalo, wants to run off, let it go. Let it run away. Otherwise it pulls your finger off, or does some more damage. Let it run away. Okay, you want to be restless? Fine, go. Because a water buffalo will only run a couple of hundred meters, maybe half a kilometer at most, and then it will stop. Because they're lazy beasts, the water buffalo, they don't like running. They just run away 200, 300, 400 meters, and then they stop. And all the farmer needs to do is then walk after them, and then take them by the cord, and then pull them back again. They're very docile. Now that's the same you do with your mind. Instead of pulling it back, if it's restless, just be mindful of it, just watch where it's going, but let it go. And with that unconditional mindfulness, it will stop, and then you can put it in. And the other stories, which I've told a couple of people in the interviews, is I told that story of the water buffalo to a Singapore girl who was staying at Bodhinyana Monastery. And for a few days, and she was getting so restless, she couldn't meditate at all. And there she was, stuck in a monastery with nothing to do. No laptops, no telephones, no mobiles, nothing. So she was getting more and more frustrated. And I told her the story of the water buffalo, and she understood it, and she started laughing. And I asked her why she started laughing, and she told me a story when she was a six-year-old girl. When she was a six-year-old girl, she was also fed up with her mummy. She had an argument with her mother, and she said, "I don't love you anymore, mummy, I'm leaving home." And the mother was a very wise woman. So she said, "Okay, I'll help you pack." So they went to this little girl's room and got her little suitcase and packed it with some clothes and a doll, teddy bear, whatever she had. And the mother gave her $20 Singaporean. No, for her lunch and her dinner and the rest of her life. And waved her off at the elevator door. "Bye-bye, darling, have a nice life." So there the little girl, 6-year-old, went off into the big world with a suitcase of clothes and dolls and $20. And of course, what happened? By the time she got to the ground floor, she was already homesick. And so she pushed the button to the floor where she lived and went straight back up. And there her mother was waiting for her. "Welcome home, darling." Now that was brilliant psychology. Because, you know, so the child, it won't run away too far. You know, it loves its mummy, it loves its home, it loves everything about the place. But just it gets into these moods sometimes. "Right, that's it, I'm leaving, I don't love you anymore." And that's the same with a water buffalo mind. That's the same with your mind when you're really restless. You know, you want to watch the breath. "No way, I don't want to watch the breath anymore. I'm not going to do it." So you say, "Okay, off you go. Here's your suitcase. Here's $20. Bye-bye." And your mind won't go all that far. Like the water buffalo, 200, 300, 400 meters down the road. And then when it settled down, "Okay, come watch the breath now." "Oh, okay," says the mind. Now that's the psychology of unconditional mindfulness. You don't control things. You work with things, understanding the nature of things. So you're not fighting battles. You're actually working with the flow of life, understanding it, and making a huge amount of peace. Mostly because you're not making problems. You're just making peace. Making peace with every moment. And by doing that, you see, making peace with these very unpromising petals which you happen to be looking at right now, it doesn't matter what it is right now you're watching, it doesn't matter what you're observing, what's in your mind now, the state of mind is not the main thing. It's making sure you've got unconditional mindfulness on it. Just watching. It's a wonderful experience when you try this. You actually see the things open out. After a little while, just the sloth and torpor, the restlessness opens. And you've got peace. And sometimes that I've been doing this with present moment awareness. Just being the present. You don't even want to go any further or deep in the meditation. You put your mindfulness on present moment, just being now. Now this is a very important thing to stress at this time of a retreat. Some of you have already packed your bags. If not physically, mentally. Only 2 and a bit days to go. Only, 60 hours to go. Not much to go now. Come on. A lot of times people always are ahead of themselves. Even just to think, only so much of this talk to go, then I can go back and back to bed. Only 3 hours to lunch. We're always planning our future so much. And especially towards the end of the retreat, if you're not saying, 2 days to go, I'm packing my bags already, you're thinking, only 2 days to go and I haven't got jhana yet. What am I going to tell my friends? This is the third or fourth retreat I've been in. If I don't get something quick, I'll be very embarrassed. And again, you're missing the point. It's not unconditional mindfulness. You're just running ahead of yourselves. And a lovely way for getting unconditional mindfulness established is actually going to the mind which does not measure. I flagged this type of meditation early on in the retreat. See if you can develop a mind which does not measure. There is a very famous poem in the Chinese Chan tradition called the Poem of the Third Zen Patriarch, which began with a very powerful opening couple of lines, saying, "The path is easy for one without any preferences." And of course, that sounds very profound. And at first I thought, that's rubbish. I'm terrified, I don't believe in all this Zen stuff. But then again, over the years, you start to contemplate that. And what did this fellow mean? Because that was obviously a powerful statement which many people remembered and which meant a lot to people's meditation. The path is easy when you don't have any preferences. It's all talking about having a mind which doesn't measure. What do you mean by a mind which doesn't measure? First of all, a mind which doesn't measure time. We are great time measurers. Just measuring the amount of time we sit in meditation. And some of you are already trying to beat your record of how long you can sit meditation. Or you're measuring sort of the depth of your meditation. How peaceful am I? And is it as peaceful as the last meditation? You're measuring things. And if you have got a good meditation, a really deep meditation so far during this retreat, you'll find you'll measure every meditation from now on by that one. And you will suffer immensely because of that. The mind which doesn't measure is like, I don't compare this moment with another moment. I don't even measure seconds and minutes and hours and days. All I measure, if anything, is this moment. Just now is the only time you ever had. And for those of you who have achieved present moment awareness, and it's been stable, how many of you have been able to meditate and time has no meaning for you? You've been sitting down there and you thought it was 5 minutes. You haven't been asleep, but hours have gone by. And it's just been like a second. Not really a second. It hasn't had any meaning at all, time. What you've got into here is you're not measuring time anymore. And that's a huge amount of freedom. So during this retreat, doesn't matter how many days have gone past, or how many days are left, or how many hours are left till lunch, don't measure time. If you measure it, you become a prisoner of it, forcing yourself to try and get something before the time runs out, or just bearing with the moment until Ajahn Brahm rings the bell that you can go somewhere else. On those retreats where we did keep these schedules, I remember this retreat I gave in Sydney, and at the end a woman came up to apologize and told me she had a love-hate relationship with me throughout the whole retreat. What do you mean a love-hate relationship? And she explained that sometimes, that when I was going to ring the bell and the hour was up, sometimes she couldn't wait for me to ring the bell. And when I rang the bell, she loved me for ringing the bell because she was hurting so much, she wanted to go somewhere else. But other times she was having this beautiful meditation. And when the hour came up and I rang the bell, she hated me for ringing the bell too early. And that was a love-hate relationship she had, because she was, like I was, a prisoner of time. What is an hour? What is 50 minutes? What is 2 hours? When you don't measure time, it has no meaning. If you look what we mean by measuring, the distance between the past and the present, the distance between the present and the future, or the distance between the past and the future, that's what we call measuring. But in the present moment, there's only one point, and nowhere to measure to or from. That's why the meaning of time disappears. And it gives you a sense of freedom, of stillness. You can't do anything when there's no time to do it in. And when you go into the silence, there you're not measuring things through thought. And that's why silence is so powerful to overcome the measuring mind. How often is it that you have an experience and you think, that was a good meditation? You've measured it. How often is it you're restless or tired and you say, that was a bad meditation? My first teacher once told me, no such thing as good or bad meditations. Didn't understand what he meant, of course. But now I've given some indication of what that means by the simile of going to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and getting no money. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are bad days. Friday, you get your paycheck. So Friday is a good day. So people decide they're only going to go to work on Fridays from now on. Obviously, that's a stupid idea. But that's what sometimes people think in their meditation. They only want the good meditations from now on. What they think are good meditations. And the so-called bad meditations, they don't want those anymore. This is what happens when we measure. We select, and it gives rise to craving and ill will. Good and bad. I want the good, I don't want the bad. What this great Zen patriarch meant, when you don't measure, this was a good meditation or a bad meditation, it's just the way the mind evolves. It's just nature, nothing to do with you. You didn't choose it, as I said yesterday. It just happens, it's called cause and effect. But how can you say it's good or bad? If you don't say it's good, you don't say it's bad. There's nothing to do anymore. It is for measuring that we go to the next stage of controlling. The key to, for me anyway, the key insight for that third Zen patriarch saying, the path is easy for those who have no preferences or no measuring, came when somebody just reminded me of this philosopher-scientist Lord Kelvin. When I think it was at Nolamara, someone asked, what do you think of Lord Kelvin, the philosopher's statement that we have to measure accurately before we can control things, because he was one of the founders of technology. Anyone who knows technology knows you have to measure things accurately first of all, and one of the biggest advances in technology in the West was when they had standard meter rules or standard clocks, so you could measure things absolutely accurately, and then you could have technology which controls our world. And it was a very powerful insight by that Lord Kelvin. But, I turned it around and said, how true that is. You have to measure accurately before you can control things. So if you don't measure at all, you can't control anything. And that became a very key concept to letting go. When you measure something, the next stage will almost follow almost automatically. You'll tend to control it then. When you don't measure it, it's out of control, you have to let go. Good or bad meditations, when you measure them, the good meditations, you want to have them again, or more likely, have them better. Once you've got the measuring scale, you want to go up, 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 up. And always it's got a scale with no end. Or you've got a bad meditation and you get depressed. You get fed up, you've got no energy anymore. All because you're measuring things. If you don't measure your meditation, not good, not bad, just a meditation. It's amazing, you can't do anything anymore. Nothing to do. And when that happens, letting go occurs. So when you stop thinking, when you go into the silence, the sound of the person snoring is just a sound, that's all. You can't do anything. It's not a good sound or a bad sound. It's not they should be or they shouldn't be. It's their nature to snore. When they burp, it's just their nature to burp. What do you expect? When they let wind from their backside, this is what happens when you have baked beans. It's nature. So don't blame anybody. It's not the baked beans' fault. It's just the way things are. So when you stop measuring things, there's a lot of peace. And stopping thinking is a way of stopping measuring things. And when you don't measure things, you don't even measure where you're going in the meditation. You stop. You stop controlling. And the sign of non-measuring is nothing to do. And the sign of nothing to do is letting go, and the sign of letting go is stillness. And the sign of stillness is the lotus starts to open out. It's just nature. When that warmth is staying on the sun, on the lotus with unconditional mindfulness, unmeasuring mindfulness, the lotus starts to open up easily. The path is easy for those who don't have any measuring mind. So be careful. So when the lotus starts from opening up, I've got breath now, it's getting really beautiful. Now what stage is that? That stage this, and I've got to go to the next stage. There's two or three stages ahead of me, and mind you, on this stage now, you got into the measuring mind, you're stuffed up. So don't measure at all. Just know this moment. It's just a beautiful breath. It's good enough. Because as that warmth of unconditional mindfulness stays on whatever you're watching, you just have to be patient. And a great help to patience, again, is having present moment awareness. You're not measuring time, so you don't care about what's going to happen next and when it's going to happen. All you're concerned with is what's happening now. The mindfulness is staying in the moment. It's not moving on to something else. You're being more fully where you are. And where you are is opening up. The sign you're doing this properly is not you just wander around and get nowhere. The sign of this actually working, that you really are unconditioned in the moment, is the lotus opens up naturally. In the present moment, before you know it, there's silence. And this is a great method because you don't even choose to go on to the next stage. That's the reason why I mention these stages, because these aren't things you go to. This is just what happens. These are like landmarks on the journey going inwards. Just what you pass through, without any effort or any design. It's just a well-worn journey, and these are the landmarks. So you go into the center of time. Time opens up, and now you can't see time anymore. You're in the moment. Thought opens up, and you're in the silent mind. You're not saying anything anymore. And for those two, that's the main two which gets the process happening. Then you're just with the breath. So often it happens, I don't even choose to watch the breath. I just present moment awareness and go be still, unconditional mindfulness at this moment. And these things just happen by themselves. I'm in the moment. Then it becomes silent. Then the breath happens. Then the breath is full in the mind, see, from the beginning to the end. And it's a beautiful breath. Then just a nimitta comes up. This is also helpful because you know these things are coming up from within the center of where you already are. Not coming up from the left or the right or anywhere else, from within the center. The next layer of petals is within the one which you can see right now. So if it's a breath, the full awareness of the breath is in the center of that. So you don't need to move. Just be with the breath going in, going out, and it just opens up to the full awareness of the breath. You don't even need to go looking and searching for the beautiful breath. You're just watching this full awareness of the breath, and it suddenly becomes delightful and beautiful. As if it opens out, and there you go deeper. You don't even need to wonder about the nimitta. Is this the nimitta? Is this not the nimitta? How do I get the nimitta? What should I do about the nimitta? That's not unconditional mindfulness anymore. That's doing something. You started thinking. Just stay with that beautiful breath. In its own time, it just opens out like a beautiful lotus. And you can see the next layer of petals, this beautiful nimitta. And again, the deeper you go into the lotus, the more delicate and fragrant and beautiful are the petals. The more you practice this unconditional mindfulness, the deeper you go in, and the more joyful it becomes. Which is why the path of meditation, when you start understanding how it works, and you get out of the way and let it happen, becomes such an easy and a pleasant, amazing path. It tells you about the nature of the mind and how it opens up and happiness and stillness and peace, but also you're seeing the very, very refined inner workings of the mind. You're going inwards, never onwards. We have a word in Buddhism, a very important word called the asavas. The asavas, the Buddha called the outflowings of the mind. And in many suttas, when he mentioned the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering or dukkha, the cause of dukkha, the end of dukkha, and the way leading to the end of dukkha, he followed that by the asavas, the cause of the asavas, the end of the asavas, and the way leading to the end of the asavas. It's almost like the outflowings were as important as the word dukkha. But, you know, most people just hear the word dukkha. And these outflowings of the mind, once you get the message, what these outflowings are, you can see what happens. In most people's lives, their mind, if you imagine it being inside, is always flowing out into the world. Flowing out into future and past. Flowing out into thought, into proliferating, into thinking about things which are none of your business. Always flowing out to the next moment. Always going outwards and onwards, or sometimes backwards, but never staying still. And this is what the Buddha sort of recognized. This is the problem. Instead of flowing outwards, keep it inwards. Go in. Go in the opposite direction. Which is what we mean by going against the stream. Instead of always going outwards to something else, go inwards to where you are. Going inwards towards the source. That is the meaning of this powerful word in Buddhism called Yonisa Manasikara. Sometimes you read this in the books called wise attention, which is not a good translation at all. Misses 90% of the meaning. It means, literally, manasikara means work of the mind. Yonisa means which goes back to the source of things. Which goes in. The word yoni is used in Pali and Sanskrit to mean the womb, like a mother's womb. It's called the yoni. And it's the source of life. In the same way, yonisa manasikara means going back into the origin of things. Not going outwards, but always going inwards. And that inward path is what we mean by the opening of the lotus. You're going into the heart of this lotus. Into the middle of restlessness. Into sloth and torpor. Into the center of it. Don't go out and try and get rid of it. Really get into it. Go in to time, into silence, into the breath, into the mind. Always going inwards, never going onwards. And that is a great rule of thumb to help you with the meditation. Doesn't matter where you are, don't go somewhere else, don't throw this away, go into it. And if you always think of going inwards, 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 you know what we mean by yonisamanasikara. You go into the heart of the lotus, right into its center. You do that by sustained attention, unconditional mindfulness, not measuring things. You go deeper and deeper in. And that's the way the journey happens, just by watching unconditionally and allowing the thing just to go in. And as you go into those refined places, of course you're going to places where few human beings ever go. That's why it's difficult to give these things names. That's why it's very easy to misunderstand what they truly mean and call it union with God or sort of cosmic consciousness or whatever. But you keep going in. And as you go to this nimitta, you find yourself falling into this nimitta. It's beautiful light. Or the whole thing envelops you and you get into incredible bliss. And you go into that. Always going in. It's like petals of lotuses opening out one after the other. And you go deeper into them. That's what we mean by yonisa manasikara. The mind works to go into the center of things. And obviously the closer you get to the center, certainly the more still, the more unworldly it becomes. And those are the jhana experiences. Which is why there is, somebody already asked me this, but I got the wrong quote because I didn't really understand what the question was. They asked me this word of another, or like getting some teachings from Aryans, where does it come from? And it comes from like a sutta in the tens, but there's another sutta which is very similar, which is the Mahavedala Sutta. And there I often quote that because many people, they want not just jhanas, they want to become enlightened. At least they want to become a stream winner in this life, and why not? I say, how do you become a stream winner? How do you actually see the Dharma and see what the Buddha saw? How do you become Aryan? And this is a brilliant teaching. You say there's two causes for seeing the Dharma, for being a stream winner. You need both of those causes there. One is like the word of another, which is like the teachings of the Aryans. You need the map. And the other one is yonisa manasikara, work of the mind which goes into the center of the lotus, which has got the map, but has also got the experiences. So you're getting close enough to the center of that lotus to get some idea of what's in the heart of things. And that's why when you get into that second jhana layer of petals, one of the things you see there very clearly is an experience that there's no one who's doing anything. The will has disappeared. And you go even deeper. Even if you don't go deeper, I use the simile of the lotus, extended it slightly by saying those inner petals of the lotus are so thin they're almost transparent. And even from the first jhana you can see to its center. Let alone the second or the third jhana, you can see that even the knower, there's nothing there. You can see right into the heart of the lotus and see what in Tibetan Buddhism we call the jewel in the heart of the lotus. What in that famous mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, Mani means the jewel, Padme is in the lotus. We've got Padma here, the jewel in the heart of Padma. Oh, Mani Padma Hum, the jewel in the heart of you is Nibbana, cessation, emptiness, nothing left. Now that's actually the great insight, which again, counterintuitive, can't see through thinking, you have to go to the source and origin of things. So by opening the lotus, you're being able to see what's in the heart of things. Sure, you might call opening the lotus samatha practice, because you have to keep that attention still, to have unconditional, unmeasuring mindfulness on this moment, on this silence, on this breath, on this beautiful breath, on this nimitta, on this jhana, to be able to go in. You go in far enough, and then you can see what's in the beginning of things. In the heart of things, in the center of things. And that's where the big insights come into what enlightenment truly is, what Nibbana is. It's always fascinating as a monk just to see how people wiggle and squirm and try and find something in the heart of their lotus. Anything will do, please. It's as if they've worked so hard to become enlightened and they want someone to be enlightened at the end of it all. They've worked so hard to get to Nirvana and now they want to enjoy it once it's there. They're missing the whole point. This is counterintuitive, a new way of looking, a new way of understanding, but this is actually what happens. You're opening the lotus of your body and mind. So, the main points of that talk today is whatever you're experiencing, this is good enough to work with. Anything is good enough to work with. Have unconditional mindfulness on this. Don't move, don't select, don't measure. And after a while, it will open up. So there's, every meditation is a good one. Everything can be used. No matter how restless, how crazy you think you are, you can still get into deep meditation. Even if you're sick. I certainly remember the time when I had typhus fever in Ubon Hospital. And that was my first year as a monk, 31 years ago. And that time Thailand certainly was a third world country. And the northeast of Thailand, for those who don't know it, that was the backwater. That was a whoop whoops, you know, the beyond the black stump area of Thailand. And in the hospital, the monk's ward was the worst of all the wards. Because no one put any money into that, it was just monks, they're the tough guys. So when I first went in with this typhus fever, I didn't know what it was, no one knew what it was. After a while I actually found there was these mites in the forest in around Bung Wai, which carried the disease of scrub typhus. But because all the villagers in that area had got a natural immunity, because they'd grown up in the area, it's only when the Western monks came and started getting sick that actually we knew there was typhus there. And for years, it was never diagnosed. It was only when a smart doctor came along from Bangkok and started coming to the monastery and said, this looks like scrub typhus. And he checked with the health department, no, there's no scrub typhus in the area. He looked again and said, this looks like scrub typhus. No, there's no scrub typhus in the area. So he used his contacts and got some researchers from Bangkok to take some samples, and yes, there's scrub typhus in the area. It's just because the locals had immunity, but obviously we didn't. So it really wears you out. It's like typhoid fever. So it's, you know, it's much, much worse than the flu. And I remember going to that hospital feeling terrible. And the first night at 6 p.m, the nurse went, they had a nurse at the end of the ward, nurse went away. And I was waiting and waiting and waiting for the night nurse. And then by 7, 8 o'clock, night nurse hadn't turned up. So I talked to the monk in the next bed in Thai. Shouldn't we sort of tell someone the night nurse hasn't come yet? This is my first day in that hospital. And they said, what do you mean night nurse? There is no night nurse. And if something goes wrong in the middle of the night, that's just bad karma. Nah, I want to go home. But the worst part of that experience, there's many worst parts of those experiences, but I remember even just, sometimes you're so weak and there's no one to help you. Because all the other monks were really weak. We tried to help each other when we could. Just even going to the toilet was at the end of the ward. If you had really good karma, you got a bed towards the end of the ward, close to the toilet. That was like the first class, like, you know, the first class or business class beds were at the end. And where I was the economy class, right down the back. And you didn't have any bedpans, and to get to the toilet, I remember just getting up and just holding the rails, and actually lurching, and just grabbing the next bed rail, and waiting there for about 5 minutes to get your energy. So it was an expedition, like going up Mount Everest to get to the toilet. But once you got there, you stayed there to make sure everything came out, because you're not going to do this twice a day. But the other worst part of this experience was because, you know, this was so many years ago, no one knew exactly how to treat these things. They just pumped you full of antibiotics. And so these were the days before disposable needles. So all the needles were recycled. They used them many, many times and tried to sterilize them. Remember, it's a third world country, so they didn't have much money. And I was convinced, and I'm pretty sure it was true, they would use the needles in Bangkok first of all, and then send them up to the northeast. And after using them in the main wards, then the needles would then be used on the monks, because we were the tough guys. And those needles were so blunt that when they never injected you, they had to stab you in the buttocks. And I always remember this nurse. She was like a middle-aged Thai lady. She was built like a water buffalo because she needed that strength to actually push it into your buttocks. And no matter how much metal I tried, no way could I have metal towards that nurse. I hated her. And every twice a day you see her coming in. Oh no. It's bad enough having a fever, but you know, having your buttocks like they've just been caned by the headmaster. Oh, they really stung every time they put them in. So that was a terrible experience. And so there I was, just feeling just so terrible with sore buttocks and this nurse coming in twice a day. But even then, I remember one day getting so fed up, I decided, no, I'm going to meditate. Just let it be. And you do these experiences and you get into these incredible deep meditations. And what it proved to me is that it doesn't matter what your body's up to, if you know how to go in and go in and go in and go in, doesn't matter what that petal on the outside of your lotus looks like. Beneath that, underneath that, inside of that, there's the most amazing, beautiful, fragrant, joyful petals. It taught me that you can use any lotus to get into jhana. You can start from the most unpromising states of mind. As long as you know what to do. Unconditional mindfulness, stay still. Don't try and go anywhere. Make peace. Be right here. And wait. And see everything just open out. Just buttocks open out into just the body which is not hurting anymore. Go into your breath, you can't feel the body, it's gone. Into the breath, and the beautiful breath, into the beautiful breath, these amazing nimittas. Where the heck do they come from? They're always there all the time, deep inside. So if you know how to go in with unconditional mindfulness, you can open up any lotus. And there you'll find the ability to easily meditate. No matter what you're doing, even if you're really sick, even if you're dying, as long as you go into the center of things, go into the middle with unconditional mindfulness, you'll find you go to places where that pain and sickness can't reach. You go into peaceful, deep places. You go to the center of things. And who knows, one day you may go so deep into the center you'll be able to see what's right there in the middle and see the emptiness. And from then on, you'll have no more problems. So that's the story of the thousand petal lotus. How to meditate. How to become enlightened. With no preferences. The easy way. If there's a shortcut, that's it. So please, take the shortcut. You've only got a couple of days to go. So any comments or questions about that talk? A thousand, yes.
Did you say something about not measuring virtue or measuring, not measuring virtue, karma, merit?
Not measuring virtue, karma or merit. Yeah, that's sometimes when we get judgmental about ourselves and think, I'm terrible, I'm awful, and often once we measure, we call that judging. And I always made the connection. A judge at a court of law, as soon as they say you're guilty, you didn't get up at 4 o'clock in this morning, or you've been thinking thoughts you shouldn't think, naughty monks. As soon as you say guilty, what comes next in a court of law? Sentence, that's right, punishment. And we've got this conceptual framework of judging is usually guilty, we see the faults in things, and then punishment, self-punishing. When we don't measure, it's very hard to punish. It's very easy to forgive people when we stop measuring. How can you judge someone? How can you really know what they did and why they did it? So come, we just leave. It's an impersonal process. We don't judge. We forgive. Which is another word for letting go. So we don't measure these things. And then they completely disappear. An interesting observation, if you don't know this already, or haven't heard me say this already, the word for mind in Pali Sanskrit is mano. And the word for measuring is manati, which if anyone who knows Pali means, manati means what mano does. So that's the nature of the mind to measure. That's what a mind is, that which measures things. So when you stop measuring, you disappear. That's why when you stop measuring things, things disappear. Your judgments of others disappear. Eventually, karma disappears. You're not measuring anymore. So, non-measuring is another way of doing the vanishing act. David Copperfield, eat your heart out. You can only make a jumbo jet disappear. We can make our minds disappear. Does that sort of answer your question, sort of? Any other question before we go off to the interviews? Yes. Patinisagaya means like giving up sort of this measuring mind. Patinisaga means like throwing things away. Throwing things away. So throw everything away, even measuring. Are you measuring if it's throwing away? Not really, I just throw things away whether I like them or not. I throw them away, throw them away, throw them away, throw them away. Keep throwing things away. There's nothing left. Then, what can I throw away? I throw my arms away. So, be innovative and see how much you can throw away. Okay, that's enough now. So, now's the time to open your lotus today. And see what's inside this crazy, restless, sort of psychopathic mind of yours. If Angulimala could become enlightened, and he was a psychopath, so can I. So you just have to go inside and see what's there. And in the meantime, we have the interviews, which are going to be happening next door. Okay, so have a nice morning. But make sure that when you have your lunch, you don't have the extra portion. No measuring, no measuring. She don't measure.